Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in St. Clair Shores, Michigan, and earned a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration from Wayne State University. Since 1993, he's been the Senior Managing Director of Integra Realty Resources, which provides world-class commercial real estate valuation, counseling, and advisory services. This has resulted in him having a tremendous pulse on the rebirth of Detroit. The lead guitarist of The Fringe, his name, Anthony Sanna. And we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Anthony Sanna, who's the Senior Managing Director of Integra Realty Resources. Anthony, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Jack, thanks for having me.
Can we start by talking about your mom and your dad and your childhood, please?
Sure. Well, I am a first-generation American. My parents both came here from Italy separately. They met here in Detroit, but they're a product of old Italians coming here to America to find work and raise a family and have a better life. And my dad always tells an interesting story where he came here on his very first day, got his host house, left the next morning, and went to find work, and found work, made $10 his first day, never stopped working, and that's exactly what he came here for.
Job in construction. How did mom and dad meet?
They met at a dance here in Detroit, and my parents, I guess, were from different parts of Italy, but when they met here, they had enough in common that they made a go of it. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and so her entire focus was on raising a family. You know, when I look back with the long view, and I take a look at how my parents raised me, it was really all about family and security and caring for them. It was really just almost one-dimensional, focused on raising these kids. And my dad just worked hard. My mom raised a family.
Your dad was a barber.
He was a barber.
You've got hair that I would die for. Both Mark Blackwell and I would die for. What kind of shampoo did he have you kids using?
I wonder if that's how barbers get in the business. If they have a good head of hair, they say, I ought to be a barber.
So what's the biggest thing mom taught you, Anthony, and what's the biggest thing dad taught you?
So dad taught me work ethic. I think just seeing him work as hard as he did and be as successful as he was, coming from an old country and coming here, he really instilled in me a sense of wanting to learn, wanting to educate myself, wanting to grow, wanting to be the best I could be, work hard. Mom, on the other hand, was more family-focused, taught me about traditional values and family and how important that is. So I think I got a well-rounded upbringing from the two of them.
While you were at Wayne State, you got a job with Comerica.
Yes.
I think you were a senior VP on day one. What did you do for Comerica?
Well, Comerica, I drove a little red truck around. I don't know if you remember back in the day, Comerica had these red trucks that drove around, and I picked up canceled checks, and I picked up mail. I went from branch to branch, and it was convenient because Comerica was headquartered downtown, and Wayne State was downtown. So it was a good way to work through college, keep work pretty close to school, make a little bit of money, and make my way through school, and keep things simple.
You graduated and you got a job with Lambrecht Realty from 85 to 88. What did you do there?
So with Lambrecht, it was a real estate company, full service mortgage real estate company that did commercial brokerage, they did property management, they did mortgages, and they so happened to have a commercial real estate department that I ended up doing an internship with. And I kind of liked what they did. They appraised commercial properties, not houses, but commercial properties like the Fisher Building here, right? They would do assignments as complicated as this. And I thought that was kind of an interesting field, and it was below the radar. Nobody really knew what commercial real estate appraisals were or who did them. I kind of fell into this by accident. I kind of liked what they did.
Early on, you got an MAI, a member of Appraisal Institute. What is that? And why did you get it?
So that is like an advanced degree in the commercial appraisal field. It's a designation provided by the Appraisal Institute. Many kind of make it similar to a master's program, but it's specific to commercial real estate. And by having that designation, you're permitted to work for banks, courts, municipalities. You're kind of elevated in your field, kind of like a CPA might be.
In 88, you went to work for Dean Appraisal Company.
So Dean Appraisal Company was a competitor to Lambrick, but I liked what they were doing there. They were growing, and they were a big firm. So I moved from downtown to Birmingham, where this firm was located, and I quickly started growing in the ranks there. And after 5 years and getting that MAI designation we talked about, I became a partner there. And so I was a young partner with five much older senior partners, but I was a partner, and I began kind of advancing my career and starting to do things that would grow the business.
And that was in 93 that you became a senior managing director. So for the next 23-plus years, you've been with Integra Realty. It's the largest such firm in Michigan. Anthony, tell us about Integra Realty Resources.
So Integra Realty Resources is a commercial appraisal and valuation firm. And what we do is we do commercial appraisals and consulting on properties other than residential. So office buildings, industrial buildings, retail, vacant land, apartment rent studies, feasibility studies. But what's unique about our profession is that we get a lot of proprietary information from our clients. So we get to see construction budgets. We get to see financial statements. We get to see rent feasibilities and all sorts of things that they're proprietary, but they help us understand the market. And when we aggregate all that data, we can suddenly make some opinions as to what's going on in the market. We see it from all sorts of perspectives. We see medical, we see municipalities, we see developers, we see property owners, and we get to work in all these different sectors and form opinions as to what the market's doing.
Okay, so you and your team appraise buildings, land, etc. What's the value in that? If I'm going to buy a building, I've got a price that I'm willing to pay. And the most important thing is not what it's appraised at. It's the most important thing, what I'm willing to pay or what the other person's willing to sell for. What value do you bring?
So as long as no one else is involved, Jack, you can pay what you want to pay for a building. A guy can sell it to you. But generally speaking, there's others involved. There's a bank that's going to loan mortgage proceeds. There's title companies that need to be protected. There's insurance companies that have a vested interest in your acquisition. So if it's just you and a buyer and you're not going to look to any of those other third parties to protect you in any way, you're right. You can pay what you want. When you start bringing in the third parties, they need an appraisal to make sure that the price is fair, it's supported, that the mortgage will support it, title work, insurance, all that will be supported by the value of the property.
You and your team at Integra focus on five sectors: retail, office, industrial, hospitality, and multifamily.
That's correct. So that makes up the commercial real estate market. Now there's some other things like land and land developments and subdivisions and you know, medical work and municipal work. But those are the five sectors that we really focus on.
When we come back, we're going to ask Anthony what's the most unique thing he's ever appraised. And I'm Jack Crisul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Crisula, and we're with Anthony Senna of Integra Realty Resources. Anthony, in your almost 30 years of doing appraisals, what's the most unique thing you've ever appraised?
We did a couple unique assignments recently. We were involved in a bridge assignment where we're looking at the actual tolls that the bridge generates in terms of how much value it can sustain from an investor standpoint. Would an investor buy this bridge based on the tolls that it generates? More recently, we've been involved in some pipeline work that's going on where they're burying gas pipelines underneath farmland. And every property owner needs to be compensated for the value of his land as the pipeline goes under that, fair compensation. So we need to value all the land that this pipeline will traverse beneath. And those are unique assignments because bridges and pipelines are not your average office building or apartment building or industrial building. They're unique, and they create challenges from a valuation perspective, but they're also kind of fun to work on.
You make the statement, quote, "You don't make money when you sell a building. You make money on it when you buy the building."
So that's an interesting concept. Investors are always looking to maximize profits, returns, yields, that sort of thing. But if you buy a property at too rich a price, when it's time to either sell or it's time to look at your cash flow during the time that you hold it, as in terms of your rental income, if you don't buy it right, you find that you don't end up making as much money as you thought you might. But if you buy it right, at that point, you start to either make money on your cash flow through rental income, or when you sell it, you end up seeing some maximized gains. So most people make the mistake on the buy side, not on the sell side.
You sound like your dad in the barbershop talking to a guy. You know, that's not professor talk. That's barbershop talk.
That's barbershop talk.
And that's reality. In your job every day, you've got an unbelievable pulse on Detroit's rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that. Someday, you could write a book on the rebirth of Detroit. And you say, the heart and soul of downtown Detroit is pumping stronger than ever.
That's true. So let's just go back a few short years, Jack, because Detroit comeback is just is so much faster, so much stronger, so much better than anyone thought it would be. If we just go back to 2008, let's just say, I would travel around the country, and we had a little bit of a black eye, right? We had some insolvency and bankruptcy issues. We had high crime. We had government corruption. We had vacant buildings everywhere. We had no streetlights working. And the number one question I would get is, you know, what's going on with Detroit? And they would ask it with an air of pity, like, we feel sorry for you. You know, it's a national joke. You've got a black eye. But now they ask, what's going on with Detroit? And there's like a sense of pride now that comes with that question. And it's almost too compelling to ignore what's been going on here, how quickly things have changed. And it's just really the comeback city. It just truly is.
All right, let's get this into some specifics. Many of these downtown Detroit iconic buildings have been abandoned for almost 40 years. Let's talk about a few, and talk to us, Anthony, about the increase in value from 2000, you know, every 5 years or so to today. So, number one, 1001 Woodward Office Building, please.
So let's take a look at that. That was the first federal building where the bank had occupied that building for a long time. It sold in 2005, and it sold for about $5 million. To the Carpenters Union, and it was predominantly vacant. So now $5 million works out to about $15 a square foot. You could buy an apartment in Manhattan for $5 million, right? But here you're getting a 300,000 square foot building, 17 stories, and it needed some work. And so the new owners put a lot of work into it, put some money into it, ended up selling it about 10 years later for about $25 million. So we go from $5 million to $25 million. And now today, if you look at that building 100% occupied with the rents that it's generating, if we were to do an appraisal today, we think it'd probably sell in a range of $35 million. So we go from $5 million to $25 to $35. I mean, we're going in the right direction, Jack.
Why didn't we have you on and meet you 10 years ago here, Anthony? Building number two, the Broderick Tower.
So the Broderick Tower is a great success story where it was one of the first multifamily redevelopment apartment projects that came downtown. And the story there is really that the rents have continued to increase. 100% occupancy in that building. The average rent is $1,550 a month in 2013. 2014, it's $1,650 a month. 2015, it's $1,750 a month. Today, it's about $1,800 a month. So the rents continue to go up almost $100 a year, sustainable growth with full occupancy.
One more, the Metropolitan Building.
So the Metropolitan Building is a unique story there in terms of it being the old jeweler's building, if you remember. It's where the watchmakers were. So it looked like an office building on the outside, but on the inside, it was more like a mall. You'd walk through there and you talk to your jewelers. That building went vacant in 78 and stayed vacant till today. Now today, we've got the Elements Hotel going in. They're spending about $25 million to restore that building to a suite-style hotel. And you look at that, it's 40 years vacant, Jack, and suddenly this building's coming back to life again with a big investment.
Tell us a little bit about one of our real gems, the Penobscot Building, you know, the 47-story phenomenal atrium, etc.
Yeah, so the Penobscot Building is where I started working back in the early 80s for Lambrecht Company. It was a great building, an iconic building, and, you know, through the years we've seen that building struggle. I think it sold for a very low single-digit per square foot number, $7, $8 a square foot, 15, 20 years ago. But now it's thriving again, right? We've got high rents in place. We've got higher occupancy. Lots of renovation going on in that building, and it's right where it needs to be, right? It's located in the heart of downtown.
Let's review how this rebirth, this miracle, has happened. okay? I think you got to go back and start with Mr. and Mrs. I, Mr. and Mrs. Illich. And they bring Little Caesars downtown in 1998. And they renovated the Fox Theater at a cost of $12 million when it was nothing down there.
Yeah, you got to give them credit, right? They believed in Detroit when nobody else did. They come downtown, they spent $12 million renovating the Fox Theater, and their dream is for a theater district, right? Mm-hmm. They developed Comerica Park in 2000s, and now they got the theater, they got the park, and you're starting to see it develop. You got Ford Stadium, Ford Field right next door, and you're starting to see a stadium district, a theater district with the State Theater, the Gem Theater, the Fox Theater. But now reality comes true with Little Caesars Arena in a true stadium district that's four professional sports teams playing within blocks apart from each other. Incredible.
A husband and a wife start a pizza joint, and they've got a dream 30 years ago, think about that, for this theater district downtown Detroit, which was impossible back then. And here it is 30 years later, and it's becoming reality right in front of our own eyes.
Yeah, and let's examine that just a little bit, Jack, because we talk about the Little Caesars arena coming to town, right? I don't think there's another major U.S. city where you can find 50 blocks of vacant land to maybe put an arena and have that 50 blocks be in the downtown district and have those 50 blocks front on the main Woodward corridor of that city, and to be able to build a stadium and entertainment district around it is unheard of, to be able to find that much land in such a great location to be able to do something only in Detroit. And that's why we are the comeback city.
Then God gave us Dennis Archer, who was mayor from 93 to 2001.
So Dennis Archer helped with the revival, right? We've got a mayor that was very pro-growth and was looking to see development in the city. And so he welcomed developers in, and that helped real estate. It was the start of what was starting to cobble together good real estate incentives and good real estate demand.
Then we had General Motors. Rick Wagner was in charge at the time. They were right across the street from the Fisher Building in their world-class headquarters. And they decide to buy this Rensen and move corporate to Rensen.
Yeah, so think about that. You got General Motors moving downtown, having faith in a downtown CBD, obviously coming from the New Center area, but coming downtown and really probably being the impetus for that Riverwalk getting developed. I mean, the river was probably the most underutilized piece of real estate in the entire Detroit region. And now what have they done? With General Motors there and all the renovations they've done to the Renaissance Center, they've been able to, with the Conservancy, create a Riverwalk that extends 3.5 miles today, but eventually 5 miles, and it's going to be just a crown jewel of Detroit.
They purchased the Rensen in 96, and in 2004, they completed a $500 million renovation that you just described.
Right. And bringing employees downtown, right? Yes. We're all talking about how this impacts real estate, and what you need to have to impact real estate is employees living, working, and playing in Detroit.
When we come back, we're going to ask Anthony Senna about the next piece, the son of Greek immigrants, and what he did toward this rebirth. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Anthony Senna, and we're talking about the transformation, the rebirth of Detroit, and specifically how it happens. So now we're up to 1999, and a Greek guy named Peter Karmanos takes his thousands of employees on Northwestern Highway and 13 Mile Road, CompuWare Corporation, builds this building downtown, and moves all those IT workers into that building.
So now we're starting to create some critical mass with employees, aren't we, Jack? We got 4,000 employees come downtown. We got a building that's being built in 2003, million square feet. Finally, our corporate headquarters comes in, new construction downtown Detroit, in the heart of the city, and really reinvigorates this area called Campus Martius. 17 stories, million square feet, 4,000 employees. That's a great, great impetus for further development.
Then there's another couple, Gene and Lois Miller, and he was the CEO of Comerica, iconic, everybody loved him, started out in the mailroom at Detroit Bank and Trust. And he and Gene and Lois would take a couple couples to the symphony, the opera, for dinner 2-3 nights a week to sell them on downtown. And Comerica commits $60 million to obtain the naming rights for Comerica Park. And the Illiches move the Tigers into that park.
Yeah, and so now you got Comerica Park, you got the naming rights there. But I think what's more important about that story, Jack, is that that's almost how it started, like a grassroots attempt to bring people in the city and to show them, get them in your car and take them to the theater, take them to restaurants. And it's amazing how people had that fortitude to say, listen, this is our city. Take a look at how good it is and drive them around and show them the sights. And for the people that wouldn't come downtown, you almost had to force them to come down here and see what was going on. And once they got down here, they could see that there's momentum here.
Then the Ford family and Ford Motor Company build Ford Field in 2002.
So Ford Field is interesting, right? Now we've got another stadium next to the Comerica Park. You're starting to create that theater district that we talked about. 65,000-seat stadium. And what's interesting about Ford Field is that's one of the few stadiums in the NFL where the field runs east and west. And the NFL doesn't dictate how you need to build a stadium, but the players don't like to play with the sun east or west. And so it's one of the few stadiums. It's not a problem at Ford Field because of the way it was designed. But obviously, we got a Super Bowl there. And if you look at the Super Bowl, it was an interesting event because do you remember who the musical halftime entertainment was for the Super Bowl, Jack? It was the Rolling Stones. So normally, the Rolling Stones would be a major coup. If you could bring the Rolling Stones into your Super Bowl in Detroit, everybody would be happy. But in Detroit, we weren't happy. We wanted Motown. We didn't have Motown represented. And so there was a little bit of anxiety over the fact that we didn't have a Motown act at the Super Bowl.
Then, at the start of this whole long segment, you talked about the corruption, what other people were telling you about the city. But we get Dave Bing, the Hall of Famer, business icon. He becomes mayor from 2009 to 2013. What did he do?
So Dave Bing kind of restored some credibility to the mayor's office, right? I mean, we were just coming off a scandal, texting and sexting and felony charges. And so we get Mr. Bing come to be our mayor. And suddenly we have kind of a noble, respected presence in the office. And he kind of restored a sense of well-being and pride in the city of Detroit. And it was needed at the right time. And then he ushered us through the bankruptcy issues. And so we needed a steady hand at that time, especially from my perspective, looking at it from a real estate perspective. You really got to think about what's going on in Detroit with this bankruptcy and how it's going to impact real estate. And Mayor Bing was pretty instrumental in keeping a steady hand for us.
Now, we've talked for 15, 16 years, and then a person by the name of Dan Gilbert comes in.
So Dan Gilbert obviously has had a major impact on the city of Detroit. On top of everything we've already talked about and all the people that came before him to kind of create some traction and synergy in downtown, Dan Gilbert was really the one that kind of created the modern-day Detroit that we see today. And, you know, we could talk about that for hours, but I think one of the first things we need to recognize is that when he came downtown, he knew that he needed to maybe be outside of a suburban location to attract the kind of employees that he wanted to attract. He needed to be in an urban setting, and that's the kind of worker he has as a tech worker, maybe a finance worker, banking. He's trying to attract those kind of employees, and he's trying to attract them from New York, San Francisco, Chicago, Boston. How do you do that in a suburban location outside of Detroit? He knew he wanted to be in Detroit.
Before Mike Duggan was mayor, he was in charge of the DMC.
So the DMC had a great turnaround under Mike Duggan, right? It just grew and expanded, and he did such good work there that obviously he was tapped to be hopefully run for mayor of the city of Detroit, which he did do. And so, his work speaks for itself. He was just so successful at the DMC, and now look at what he's been doing with the city of Detroit. Just incredible turnaround.
Then a quiet man. If the truth ever comes out of what this man's done, Roger Penske, what has he helped?
Well, Roger Penske was instrumental in back in the Super Bowl days. He was chairman of the Super Bowl committee, and he was instrumental in bringing that Super Bowl to town and then dressing up the town so that it was prepared for a Super Bowl. Now, back then, some of that might have been a little bit of smoke and mirrors because they were painting over storefronts. They were demolishing some smaller buildings and creating some green spaces, and they were dressing the city up. But back then, there was probably 50 vacant buildings within the CBD that were major commercial buildings that were vacant. And he had to kind of give the impression that the city wasn't as bad as it was at the time. But he did a great job. The city looked wonderful when the Super Bowl came here. But you fast forward, you know, 7 or 8 years, and now there's no masking, there's no paint. It's real. It's a true renaissance and recovery. Those stores and those storefronts and those buildings are no longer vacant. They are occupied.
We had no street sweepers that were working back then for that Super Bowl. He went and rented a dozen street sweepers from Indianapolis and a dozen from Chicago to clean every one of these streets, to clean the expressways, sandblasted buildings. The amount of money, his own money that he spent, was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Very quietly.
And that goes underrated, right? Very quietly, his own money to make the city look great. And it did.
And he would be showing up at 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night every night, you know, a month before or so, to encourage people, et cetera, get the workers to do the work. So, even the archdiocese is involved. There's a Monsignor Chuck Kosenki, who's done a great job in renovating parishes. And recently, Archbishop Vigneron sent him downtown to become the pastor of Most Holy Trinity Parish and St. Anne Parish, right by the old Tiger Stadium.
Right. So we've got two major churches that have been renovated in Corktown. And what does a church do for a community? It stabilizes. The gentrification that goes on when a church renovates and becomes part of the community. It always was part of the community, but with the renovation, that kind of sustains it for a longer period of time. And so we know that these churches are going to be around for a while. And, you know, I don't know about you, Jack, but, you know, my church is a sense of community, right? People come there, and it's you volunteer, you work for the church, you work with the church. It brings comfort to those neighborhoods and hopefully more development. Again, from a real estate perspective, we see values rise when the neighborhoods are stable.
We're talking to Anthony Senna, and just a couple weeks ago, Olympia Entertainment announced that Kid Rock would perform 4 concerts in September to open up this new arena. When we come back, we're going to talk to him about the arena and the arena district. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Anthony Senna, who's also the lead guitarist of The Fringe. And here's a segment from one of his cuts, Annabelle.
And I've been hanging on a thread, just a heartbeat away from dead. Hold my breath, close my eyes, faith in God is hard to find. All these nights I spent alone, Annabelle, wherever you go. Annabelle.
That was Annabelle. And Tom Wilson and Olympia Entertainment wanted you guys to open up the arena, Anthony, but you couldn't cut a deal. You wanted too much money, bad appraisal. So they had to go with this guy, Bob Ritchie, a.k.a. Kid Rock. The arena district, please.
So the arena district is interesting, Jack, and I wish I was warming up for Kid Rock, but that's okay. The arena district is just an amazing flurry of activity, right? We've got a stadium, but that's just what anchors that district. What we really have is a lot of retail, commercial, and apartments. We just worked on some apartments there where our market study indicated that the rents were approaching $3 a square foot. $3 a square foot to live in that arena district. And that's what's going on there. It's just a dynamic place, and it's starting to approach, you know, big city prices, right? Not just Detroit, but we're talking New York, Chicago, those kind of prices. And that's what's going on there. It's a real deal.
Whereas 10 years ago, investors were laughing at you when you said you were from Detroit. Now investors worldwide are coming in interested, one into this action. Talk about that.
Right. So it was just a few people that were buying up Detroit over the last 5-6 years, and we know who they are. But now we're starting to get interest from investors all over the world. The phone's just ringing off the hook from investors that want to know what's going on in Detroit. It's a comeback city, and there's still a tremendous amount of opportunity here. The pricing here, when you compare it to the East Coast or the West Coast, is so much lower And there's so much more upside and opportunity for investors to come in and really create some value there. And that's what investors in real estate are looking at, how to create value.
You've watched this rebirth for 20 years. What's amazed you, Anthony Senna, the most?
Well, if we look at the Gilbert factor, I mean, he brought in so many workers and created so much traction and critical mass here. And had he just bought a single building, and whether by design or by accident, he didn't do one single headquarter building where he might have had 10,000 employees in a single building, riding up and down elevators and rarely exiting the building. Instead, what he was forced to do was buy a number of buildings. So he bought the CompuWare building, the First National building, 1001 Woodward, the Dime building, the Chase building. Having employees in all these buildings and having them interact on the streets and having them walk out and meet for lunch or go to meetings created kind of a buzz on the streets of Detroit that really accelerated this need for restaurants and services. And you've got all this dynamic activity now, and investors are seeing that. They want to come into Detroit and be part of that activity.
Anthony Senna, describe for us Woodward Avenue from West Grand Boulevard going down to the river by 2020.
So with the M1 rail coming, we're going to see much more activity than we've already seen. And if you go down Woodward now, you don't see a lot of vacant sites, a lot of vacant buildings. They've all been gobbled up because there's so much development opportunity there. But by 2020, with the M1 rail in place, I think you're going to see what's called transit-oriented development take place. Every stop along that way is going to have development along it, restaurants, coffee shops, services. It's going to be really a boon for real estate owners to develop their properties and attract the people that are already there coming into their establishments.
Talk about the retail market, national retailers coming to downtown.
So that's something new too, isn't it, Jack? We've got national retailers that are locating in the heart of the city. You've got Under Armour, John Varvatos, Warby Parker, the eyeglass place, Bonobos, Nike, Moose Jaw, and the list gets longer and longer. And when you start to see national retailers come to a city, you're really starting to see traction.
We've got these young professionals coming downtown, but people say we've got to figure out that when these kids get married and have a couple kids, they stay downtown. How does that change? Because now they go to Ferndale, they go to Royal Oak, etc., when they've got kids 2, 3, 4 years old. Yeah.
So that's a challenge, right? We've got a lot of empty nesters coming down here. We've got a lot of young couples coming down here and young individuals. Now the next challenge is how do we get families to come down here, to live down here, to send their kids to school here? And that's part of the evolution. Now that's kind of the next step. That's going to take some work and effort. That's probably the hardest part of this puzzle, right? But we got the pieces in place, and we've got some good traction. We got some good dynamics going on downtown, and now we got to attract the families.
I believe in 15 and 16, there were over 80 new bars and or restaurants that opened in downtown Detroit, and they're talking about many, many more within the arena and within the district. How are they all going to make it?
Well, you know, we've got the right kind of worker down here and the right kind of person that lives down here. They're well-educated. They make money. They want to work here. They want to play here. And restaurants are part of that formula. Detroit was just recently named North America's top unexpected food city. North America's top unexpected food city. That's a great honor. That was by National Geographic. New York Times just announced that Detroit made the list of the annual 52 places to go. You know, so Detroit, who had been vilified for so many years, suddenly is getting some great press, and it's good to see.
These last few years, Gilbert and others haven't been able to renovate these buildings fast enough for lofts, condos. You're predicting within the next 5 years, many, many multifamily units of 10 to 20 units being built along this Woodward Quarter.
Yeah, so if you look at the apartment market, we're delivering about 1,000 apartments a year over the last couple of years in the city of Detroit. There's about 5,000 apartments on the block that are either developed, proposed, or under construction and permitted and approved. Capitol Park is a great example, right? 2, 3 years ago, you could barely walk through Capitol Park. All the buildings around it were vacant, beautiful park, but it had been abandoned for decades. Now, not just one developer, multiple developers have gobbled up all those buildings, have started to renovate and convert, and Capitol Park has 700 units now, and it's a beautiful place to live. It's just become kind of this oasis in the middle of the city that in 2 or 3 short years is almost 100% occupied at these rents that I told you before were $2 a square foot. And along the Woodward Corridor, you're going to see rental units, apartment rental units, from the new center right down to the river. It's amazing.
Within the last month, Gilbert's announced going to buy the old Free Press building, renovate that, and this whole Corktown area. Talk about that rebirth that's going on.
It just continues to expand, right? First, we talk about the Woodward Corridor, where all the action is. Then we say it's Capitol Park. We're talking residential now for a moment. But now it's downtown, where the Free Press building is. It's into Corktown. And that's how a city kind of starts to expand and develop, right? It's not just a core area anymore. It starts to expand, and eventually we'd like to see that expansion go into the neighborhoods, right? That's what's really in dire need of some redevelopment is neighborhoods. But it's got to start somewhere. And it goes north and south first, then it starts to go a little bit east and west, Jack.
You've described for us the unbelievable increase in value of these buildings. Is it at a bubble? Have we reached the zenith? Or what's your prediction?
Well, as we talked about before, Detroit is underpriced relative to other cities across the country. And that's what's driving investors to come here. The returns are higher. The upside in rent is higher. The resale price is higher than they can get in the cities where they're coming from. And so when you see that influx of investors coming into Detroit and having faith in continued property appreciation, we like to think it's going to continue.
As our time winds down together this evening, what advice would you give to a young listener?
You know, I think that you'd want to be a part of the revitalization of Detroit. This is truly the comeback city. The New York Times has a quote that Detroit is a giant candy store for young college graduates wanting to be their own boss. It's a very entrepreneurial city. It's got a heart and soul. It beats loudly. It's kind of edgy. It's cool. And young people, you know, are making that happen. And it's not just a one-dimensional recovery. We talked about apartments are doing well here. The hotels we touched upon, that there's three or four hotels proposed, the Shinola Hotel, the Foundation Hotel, the Elements Hotel. The office market's out of control, as we already discussed. Retailers coming here. We've got the Stadium District, the M1 Rail. New high-rises are projected. Dan Gilbert's talking about building a few new high-rises. I mean, this is a well-rounded comeback that is not just a one-dimensional, one area is doing well. We've got the artists want to come here because it's a gritty city. I mean, all these things combined make for like a long-term, well-rounded comeback that I think any young entrepreneur would want to be a part of.
And any young listener tonight, if you want to have a role model, just meet Anthony Senna. He's an Horatio Alger story. What you're doing and how you're doing it and the class you're doing with is phenomenal. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.